From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Say, processed food. And we've all been well-trained to say, yuck. It's a ready shorthand for industrial agriculture and the processed carbs and sugar and fat and salt that have left too much of America obese and unhealthy. But what if the mad genius that made SpaghettiOs and Dorito tacos was thrown into healthy processed food? Is that absolutely an oxymoron, fundamentally a contradiction in terms? This hour On Point, could processed food become mass-produced health food? Or is that dreaming? You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Are Burger King's low-cal fries a sign? Can we get to better eating through chemistry? Could processed food become health food? Or is that just too far from the garden? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The Wayback Machine here, Morgan Spurlock's 2004 documentary, Supersize Me, talking about the dangers of eating an excessive amount of fast food. The trailer features Spurlock talking with his girlfriend and his doctors about the consequences of his all McDonald's diet.
I think I'm going to have to go supersize.
It's hard for me to watch him go through this.
So it seems like you're starting to get addicted to it now.
You saw these numbers, right?
These numbers are outrageous.
Unfortunately, you caused some major harm to your heart, your liver, your blood.
You're gonna die. You'll die.
I want more, 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 more.
You gotta stop.
Processed food. Fast food as Frankenstein. This week, something a little new. Burger King's out there making a lot of a new low-calorie, or anyway, 70 fewer calories per regular serving, French fry. Here's an ad for the Satis Fry.
New Satis Fries from Burger King. A delicious new choice with 40% less fat, 30% less calories, and big taste. Cut from whole potatoes, fried to perfection to satisfy our lives.
How do they do that? I don't know if we want to know, but we're going to look in this hour at that and much more. Joining me now from San Francisco is Caitlin Roper, senior editor at Wired Magazine, at the heart of Wired's October food issue. The cover says, Crazy Good, the miracle of processed food. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Caitlin, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
You guys are always rebels. First of all, what does Wired in Silicon Valley know about food at all? I thought you guys were like, you know, chips and memory cards.
Well, you know, food is science and science interests us. And obviously the food industry involves a lot of technology and innovation that fascinates us.
Food is science. You know, there's the whole opposite movement, which is very strong, organic, local, straight out of the garden. You're going the other way in this issue. What's grabbed your attention, Caitlin?
Well, look, you know, whole foods are delicious and good for us, but nutritious food is not like simply a ripe peach plucked from a tree and given to a rosy-cheeked child. You know, processed foods range from the neon Doritos Loco Taco on our October cover, mm-hmm. but, you know, and that flavor and crunch was designed in a lab over 3 years. But engineering, food engineering and food R&D is also done by David Chang at the Momofuku Culinary Lab and by Ethan Brown at Beyond Meat, working to, you know, address the global animal protein shortage, mm-hmm. And by most chefs tinkering in the kitchen. So our point is really that the term processed food now has such a terrible reputation that, you know, we're losing sight of how processing can solve problems and boost nutrition and also just make things taste really good.
So some of what you're writing about in this big cover piece, collection of pieces, is just sort of the dazzling part of food science and engineering today. And some of it is about engineering for health. We're going to go to the health in some depth, but let's go first to the dazzle. I mean, what's going on? What's the frontier of food engineering that brings out dazzling, maybe irresistible tastes and foods?
Well, you know, you have scientists and chefs working in the lab kitchens on things like mouthfeel, right? Like what something is going to taste like in your mouth, how the flavors release as you eat something. And you know, that makes things taste really good. It makes menu items at restaurants like that belong to Thomas Keller, as well as at a place like Burger King, taste delicious. And so, you know, to sort of shrug our shoulders at the whole entire idea and think that everything has to be a whole food, I think both limits the kinds of things we can eat and experience, and also takes for granted the fact that a lot of people can't afford to buy farm-to-table groceries for every meal.
Lots of big issues there. What about some of the science that's making mouthfeel and flavor taste different, better? You write a lot about umami, which has got a lot of attention, the way it's being used, about, I mean, how people are... I think I've read about how they're changing salt, so it's got less sodium, changing fat, so you get the mouthfeel of fat, but with less actual fat. There's some heavy-duty frontier pushing here.
Yeah, I mean, New Salt is a company we talk about in the issue, and it has basically figured out a process that allows you to take some of the harm away from salt without losing the salty flavor enhancing quality. And you know, there's a company, Ento, that is creating sushi from insects. And you get the range of things that are both to solve a problem and be good for you, but also to taste delicious. You know, that the powder on those Dorito Locos tacos, it's neon and it might be off-putting, but it sticks to your fingers just like when you eat a Dorito chip. And that effect was something they were seeking out in the lab and were able to achieve. And it really pleases customers.
Sushi from insects? Are we talking science here or just, I'm looking at the photographs, bugs on a plate?
Well, those bugs on a plate are there to really drive it home for the reader. But Ento's bento boxes, essentially what they're trying to do is not have any bug shapes in your sushi rolls, but to use ground insects as part of a protein source, sort of like a flour, to create those rolls and to try to kind of get over that ick factor that people feel about eating bugs. So, you know, I don't know that I'm really eager to eat one. How do you feel, Don?
Ask me after lunch. I don't know. I mean, look, it's a brave new world. There are a lot of people on the planet. There are a lot of mouths to feed. But this equation of processed food and unhealthy has been strong for a reason historically. And I'm very curious about how we might break out of that. Caitlin Roper is senior editor at Wired Magazine. They're writing about it big time, all kinds of science going into food. I want to turn, Caitlin, if I may, to one of those that you've profiled here, talking about here, Ethan Brown. He's founder and chief executive officer of Beyond Meat, a company that's developing new plant protein products like chicken-free strips made from soy peas. Let's see. You've got Silicon Valley investment in this thing. Here's a little bit from a video. We'll bring Ethan in a second. But here's co-founder of Twitter. This is Biz Stone explaining the goal of his company, Obvious Corporation, investing in Beyond Meat.
The idea of it was to build systems that help people help each other to make the world a better place. What we're doing is partnering with companies and entrepreneurs who are making that their core, such as Beyond Meat.
Oh, happy, bouncy music, and we are Beyond Meat. Ethan Brown is with us from El Segundo, California, founder, CEO of Beyond Meat. Ethan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Caitlin. I appreciate you having me on.
Sure. What are you making there?
Sure. So what we've done is we've taken the bird, and in the case of our beef product, which is coming out, taking the animal out of the process for creating protein for the center of the plate. What we're doing is we're taking protein directly from plants, in this case soy and pea protein, and running it through a very simple heating, cooling, and pressure process that allows us to mimic the fiber structure that you find in animal protein or meat.
Why do it?
I think there are a lot of reasons to do it, and we've been really fortunate to be at a period in history where those reasons are becoming more and more evident to folks throughout society. We look at four basic reasons, the first being human health, just the link between meat consumption and diabetes, cancer, et cetera. Second being resource utilization. You know, as you noted, there's just a growing population and it's a finite resource base, so you have to be able to use those resources more efficiently.
Yeah.
I think the third is climate, and this is not a well-known fact, but one that is increasingly out there, and that's that 51% of greenhouse gas emissions can be attributed to the raising of livestock. And whether that number is debated or not, it's certainly a very significant part of the problem. And it's one that we can easily change without having to change entire infrastructure, without having to put in, you know, hydrogen fueling stations or electric chargers all throughout the country. This is something that's very simple. It's just changing what you put at the center of the plate at lunch, breakfast. and at dinner. And the last, and one that's pretty dear to my heart, is animal welfare. I think there's a growing number of people that are becoming exposed to the conditions that industrial agriculture is putting animals in. And I think that's making people uncomfortable.
So we get the reasons for it. We'll talk about taste and all that. But, you know, this is definitely processed food. I mean, this is highly processed food, not in a refined way exactly. But, yeah, I mean, and you must get people kicking back just on – you must have people who say, well, why meat at all, Ethan? And then, yuck, I don't want something that came out of industrialized agriculture and out of a tube somewhere.
Right, right. So I love this discussion because I think it's really fascinating and shows the interplay between psychology and food. Certainly there is an element of processing to what we're doing, but if you take a step back and look at food production overall and the level of processing that goes on into creating a chicken today, you know, a chicken is born and 6 weeks later is slaughtered, and it's a enormous amount of process that goes into doing that. You know, what we've done is taken the bird basically out of the equation and become more efficient.
But you've still got industrial soy production in there, and I'm sure a whole lot more. I mean, this is part of factory farming in a different way.
That's true. That's true. I think in order to feed the population that we have, it's going to be difficult to do that without having large scale processes like the one that we're doing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the wild world of processed food and whether it could become our next health food or if that is dreaming. Caitlin Roper is here from San Francisco, senior editor at Wired Magazine. Big cover story, lots of wild stories about what's being engineered scientifically in the realm of food. Ethan Brown is with us. He's founder and chief executive officer of Beyond Meat. It's a company that developing new plant protein products. The thing in the center of your plate, but not from animals. Certainly not all of this engineering is for health food. Here's a little bit from one of Taco Bell's stunt foods. They're a taco wrapped in a Dorito.
They should make a cool ranch one.
I'm tweeting that.
Why they don't make a cool ranch one?
We know. Did. Introducing the Cool Ranch Doritos Locos Taco.
Doritos Locos Tacos. Who needs them? A lot of people think, wow, that's jazzy flavor. Now we've got Burger King out with their locale French fry. CNN's Erin Burnett tasted the new Satisfries on Tuesday. Here's her reaction.
We went out and bought tons of them. Personally, they did taste normal, but they had a funky aftertaste. I don't know. Just saying. Honest opinion.
Just saying. Honest opinion. I'm sure Burger King hated that. Ethan Brown, I've had years in China, you know, the Buddhists there for centuries have made the equivalent of meat out of vegetables. I mean, stuff that's made to taste like meat, and it's pretty darn good. What's the reaction to the flavor of your I don't want to call it fake chicken, but whatever the right word is here, fake chicken?
Sure. No, I appreciate that. And yeah, I looked a lot at the products in Asia, and I agree that there is a lot of great innovation that's happened there over a very long period of time. The reaction here in the U.S. to what we've done has been phenomenal. We had a launch in Whole Foods, and I think ABC News reported that fake chicken was flying off the shelves. We've really had a rapid and satisfying expansion, so it's been a nice start.
And if this should take off and Americans start substituting plant-based, Beyond Meat products, let's say, whatever the brand or the label, for real meat, what's the consequence for our climate, for our health?
Yeah, I think they'd be significant, and that's what motivates me so much and so many people in our company. From a climate perspective, it is the single most important thing you can do. It is something that you can impact the rate of climate change and make a real contribution in your lifetime in the next 10-year period. Of course, there's other things we need to be doing in renewable energy, et cetera. But this is so close to what people can change themselves that I think it's really unique in that manner. And on human health, I mean, you see story after story of folks that have struggled with hypertension, cholesterol, heart disease, et cetera, and they've made the very simple change to a plant-based diet and gone off all the medications, et cetera. So, I think there's just a mounting amount of evidence that know, these changes are both good for us and good for the planet that we're sharing.
Ethan Brown, CEO of Beyond Meat, joining us from El Segundo, California. Ethan, good luck. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Caitlin Roper at Wired Magazine, you got Biz Stone of Twitter in the middle of this thing, investing in this. Is this a hot issue in Silicon Valley these days, engineered food?
Oh, absolutely. I think you have venture capitalists and investors looking to the food industry and seeing what's going to disrupt it, what might make a significant change, and in BizStone's case, what might actually help the world as well.
We're digging in here. Maybe right. David Friedman joins us right now. Stand by, Caitlin. David's with me in the studio. Writes about medicine, obesity, technology, and business for The Atlantic and Scientific American. He wrote a big piece for the June issue of The Atlantic, headlined, How Junk Food Can End Obesity. David Friedman, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, pleasure.
How can it do that?
Well, look, we'd love to get everybody eating vegetables. We'd love to see them eating fruit and lots of farm fresh stuff. Most people can't access it. They can't afford it, especially the people who have an obesity problem. What we can do is try to get the food that they do eat and they do love to have less fat, less calories, less sugar, and they're ready to eat it. If it can taste as good and give them the same stimulation, then we are well on our way to solving a very serious crisis.
The companies that sell most of that food historically have been interested in selling a lot of it. And to do that, they've wanted it to be almost addictively flavorful. Mouthfeel, fat, all the salt, sugar, all the rest. How are they going to climb off of that long tradition of making it big, fast, and bad?
The food companies are in a tough position right now. It's true. They've given us basically what we're born loving, which is really fatty, sugary, salty foods, and they've made a lot of money doing it. They'll do whatever it takes to continue to make a lot of money. If the pressure is on them and if we give them a way to actually make a lot of money by selling healthier food, that's exactly what they'll do, not for the good of humanity, but because that's where the money will lie.
The money will lie there because people will demand it?
Well, people more and more are starting to demand it, but more to the point is people are becoming aware that there's a lot of benefit, that they'll live a lot longer if they eat healthier foods. If they don't have to give up anything to do it, then it becomes a bit of a no-brainer. And that's what we're seeing, for example, with Burger King's fries. You get the taste of the fries. You don't have to make any big changes in your life. It's not going to the gym and sweating.
Yeah.
It's eating what you love eating, and you take in less calories doing it.
So, Caitlin, there's the science coming in trying to make it feel and taste just as yummy as it does when it's unhealthy, but make it healthy.
Absolutely. You know, I'm thinking about this quote from David Chang, who introduced our food package. Mm-hmm. He said, once you realize cooking is a science, you realize it's the only science in which innovation is frowned upon, where there are powerful efforts to stifle and stall innovation. And that really caught my eye. I think there's something really to that, and that Mr. Friedman talks about in his excellent story as well.
Boy, you think of all the energy that went into throwing the brakes on bad processed food, and now here we are being told, you know what, it could be processed in a good way. Let's hear from our listeners, if we may. Bill in Lancaster, Wisconsin. Bill, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, I guess you guys got to the point where I was going to go, and my point was the American consumer wants three things. They want cheap, they want easy, they want yummy, but mostly they want cheap. The big industry has absolutely no incentive to give them anything but what they want.
Do you think that people's understanding of health benefits will be enough, will make enough market demand for that, Bill, to push big food, you know, out of cheap, easy, and unhealthy and into a healthier realm?
Well, I'm an organic chicken farmer, and I have a devil of a time getting people convinced that they shouldn't pay $1.69 a dozen for their eggs, and they should be paying $3.69 a dozen for a better quality egg.
So your experience makes you skeptical.
Yeah, I get it all the time. I can't pay $3.69 a dozen for eggs. Well, probably should be.
Bill, stand by. David Friedman, what do you say to our organic chicken farmer who says people aren't going to step up and pay for it?
Well, I think, Bill, frankly, you're right. A lot of people absolutely can't. A lot of people perhaps could afford to, but choose not to. It's true. We're a very value-driven economy. A lot of people are poor. It's the obese or disproportionately poor. You're probably selling a terrific product. I would love to buy it. And I think over time, perhaps there are ways of driving down the costs of some of these higher quality products. But in the meantime, I think we have an obligation to help those people who can't afford higher quality products like yours at least get a healthier product. So if there are some of the benefits that you can bring in through organic farming that can be brought to some of the cheaper products, that's going to be a great health benefit to America.
But we get the skepticism there for Bill about whether people will go over and actually put their market strength behind that. Bill, good luck with your chickens there. Paul in Springfield, Kentucky. Paul, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, loud and clear. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I'm also an organic farmer, and I do vegetables. And, you know, where to begin? This sounds like, to me, more of the same. It just sounds like more of the same. Here we are. We have these problems with people that have been largely traced to industrialized and processed foods, and yet we're going to take more energy and try to convince people that we can make it better. And then if you look at the industry itself that's been behind a lot of this and you follow the money there, they have a horrible track record throughout the decades. So it just seems like more of the same to me. And furthermore, it sounds like arrogance of the species that we think that we can perfect upon something that is already really quite good just as it is. And so that's all I have to add, and thank you for taking my call.
I appreciate your call, Paul. Okay, David. I mean, Caitlin says, look, cooking itself is chemistry. When you heat things and fry things, and you're changing their chemistry. So, but you hear from Paul that arrogance of the species, it's the old sort of back to the land is going to be better impulse that's been very strong, and we know in many ways that's been true. He's just skeptical that this ends up in a healthy place rather than just sort of wagging us around and leaving us unhealthy.
Well, first of all, we don't know where this is going to end up. It's a rapidly changing situation. What society is looking for, our understanding of the health situation and the processed food industry are all changing really, really rapidly. Who knows what's going to happen? But Paul makes some great points. Look, we'd all like to eat naturally. All things being equal, we can assume that may be the healthier way to go. However, the fact of the matter is there's really no science to back up the notion that processed food is inherently unhealthy in any way whatsoever. We know, in fact, and science backs this up, we can make it substantially healthier than other foods in many ways. Now, there's a tremendous movement out there that says, no, that's not possible. Natural is always better. It's a great narrative. It's a romantic idea. The science isn't there to back that notion up.
So, you know, in your big piece in The Atlantic and all these pieces in Wired, where do you see, what scientific advances do you see that are economical, that could be implemented most effectively to get into the processed food mainstream and make it healthier?
So we could actually do this today, and you're seeing it with the Burger King fries are a great example. But the basic idea is you find ways of giving the sensations of fat and sugar and salt while you're actually using less of it. That's going to reduce the calories. That's the most important thing. And take out some of the ingredients that we know are contributing, are really driving the obesity crisis. If you can do that without taking away from the flavor sensations, the mouthfeel, and the general satisfaction that people get from eating these foods, and if you can keep the cost down, then you just have a win-win situation here. The alternative is, well, natural foods. Great. If you can do it, go do it. We've been telling people to do it for decades now. Eat your vegetables.
Yeah, yeah.
This isn't news. People don't do it. We don't know how to make them do it. Many of them can't afford it or access it.
Caitlin, give us a little more of the science that might be pushing more flavor, that yummy mouthfeel, general satisfaction without the unhealthy downsides. Where's the innovation happening?
Well, there continue to be salts with fewer harms. There is also there are fats, reductions of fats, but amping up other ingredients to compensate for the lack of fat, so
like,
that something
like
tastes
what?
As creamy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, so you mean what other ingredients?
Well, I mean, how do you manipulate the fat, or add what other ingredients could you throw in there that would give me the that mouthfeel, but without the heart attack?
Well, there's umami flavors that we talk a lot about in the issue, that fermented foods can add a kind of extra flavor richness mm-hmm. that is not from fat, but is from fermentation, for mm-hmm. instance. Mm-hmm. You get Umami Burger, that very popular, chain, does that in their burgers. I'm not saying they're low fat. Mm-hmm. hamburgers, but I'm saying they think about constructing a sandwich that's going to have all this sort of umami pow, mm-hmm. and the umami pow comes from a crispy Parmesan, a Parmesan crisp, as well as, mushrooms, which have a high umami flavor, and those things add real delicious enhancements to food that aren't from fat.
What makes us go in this direction with all this science instead of just plowing on down the unhealthy road? I mean, you also write, Caitlin, here about extreme fast food, and one of your examples is the Pop-Tart ice cream sandwich, an ice cream sandwich with a Pop-Tart on either side. I mean, we can go that way, too, with all this funky, fun science.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't want to misrepresent what we are doing in this issue, which is really to show the range mm-hmm. And to be really upfront that there are plenty of things. We're not suggesting that the Pop-Tart is Pop-Tart ice cream sandwich from Carl's Jr. is a healthy food option. But we're trying to show that the application of that scientific thinking goes across the board to solve problems, as Ethan Brown talked about from Beyond Meat, as well as to make things that people want to buy. I think, you know, to David's point, mm-hmm. You want to do all of it, right? You want to educate the public about things that are good for them, as well as trying to reduce some of the harm of the foods we know they're buying. And I really can't see an argument against doing both of those things.
And I'm reading here about people trying to get into that kind of snack food flow with healthier alternatives: brown rice, crackers, dried kale leaves, spiced dried chickpeas, roasted seaweed snacks. Caitlin Roper, David Friedman, stand by. I want to welcome Michael Moss into our conversation. Joins us from New York, investigative reporter for the New York Times. Won a Pulitzer Prize back in 2010 for an explanatory reporting on the dangers of contaminated meat, and he's author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael Moss, welcome to On Point.
Nice to talk to you again, Tom.
We've got new science. It could be applied in ways that would make processed food healthier. Do you believe that, A, and do you think it'll happen, B?
You know, you're mentioning the Pulitzer Prize. It reminded me of the story I wrote about the meat industry, the processing of burger, and the introduction of that processed meat product that became known as pink slime. That was created by a man who was intensely scientific and convinced that he could make the world better by making hamburger leaner by using those scraps of meat from the most sort of fatty part of the carcass. In his case, the problem he had was that he needed to treat it to prevent any possible contamination from pathogens, because it came from the most exposed part of the cow, and that's where he started using ammonia, and thus it became hit with that term pink slime. But but really, Tom, I'm really struck here by the disconnect between this conversation and effort going on in Silicon Valley and the food giants as I know and write about them. On the one hand, while I don't see them as these evil empires that intentionally set out to make us overweight or otherwise ill, you know, they have this collective zeal to do what all companies do, which is make as much money as possible by selling as much product as possible. But they're incredibly risk averse. I talk about, you know, one manager wanting to create a new lower fat peanut butter. He explained to me, you know, to really get that on the market, I would risk my entire job, have to spend millions of dollars, and I'm not about to do that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the wild world of processed food and whether it could become our next health food. In spite of everything that we've sort of heard and learned, and many people thought for decades now. Still a lot of skepticism to judge from our feedback online here. We'll look at that. Caitlin Roper is with us, senior editor at Wired Magazine. A big chunk of their bright orange magazine this month is devoted to processed food and everything that's going on there. David Friedman has written about all this for The Atlantic. In June, his big piece was How Junk Food Can End Obesity. He's saying, let's get real. This is a way to get it out to people if we do it right. Michael Moss is skeptical. He's with the New York Times and author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. You know, the at this point, the kind of psychological presumption against this is very deep, David Friedman. Here's Brad writing to us on Facebook, and we just put the question up, could processed food one day be health food? And he says, Brad writes, I can't believe that this is even a real question or that anyone could possibly answer yes. But you are answering yes.
Well, I am indeed. And so the objection being raised here, we've just heard it from Michael, and Brad seems to be suggesting it as well, is that, look, we know these companies. We know what they've done. We've seen their history. They're just not going to do it. Well, look, just in the past few months, we've seen, I mean, just yesterday, we see Burger King come out with lower calorie French fries, a core product, the core junk food. They have a healthier version of it. Mm-hmm. McDonald's brought out a healthier version of its Egg McMuffin. They've got some great grilled chicken sandwiches. We've seen a turkey burger from Burger King, all in the past few months. So my question to these people who raise this objection is, what is it exactly that the food companies have to do before you'll say, well, I guess they are capable of improving. We're seeing the improvements. Let's reward them for it.
Caitlin, do you feel the impulse in, you know, big food to make this turn? Or are you talking with, I mean, you're in Silicon Valley. Are you talking with guys like Biz Stone from Twitter, sort of new investors, but really at the edges of the food pipeline? Do you think established mainstream food producers in this country will go this way, Caitlin?
Absolutely. I think, as David puts it, we're seeing some of that effort. And I think another very important point he's making is that just the simple fact that they're making these efforts makes eaters and fast food drive-through passengers think a little bit about other possibilities. If Burger King is able to eliminate calories from French fries, why shouldn't we encourage them to do so? No one, not David and certainly not I, is saying that we think this is somehow palliative and the perfect answer that will fix the obesity problem in the United States, or that it's the end of the conversation. It can't be ignored as if it isn't happening. And I think, you know, Biz Stone's interest in Beyond Meat, that is one sort of rarefied example. Mm-hmm. Beyond Meat is an excellent product sold in Whole Foods, but that doesn't access the millions of Americans, you know, who can't afford to shop there.
Hey, Michael, what about it? Now Burger King's got a lower calorie French fry out there. Now, it's still a French fry, but presumably the heat is on at McDonald's right now to match that. Why couldn't we get a sort of competitive race to healthier processed, even fast food?
Well, I'm not sure the heat is on. I mean, if the CNN report is correct and it leaves you with a funky taste, I'm not sure that McDonald's is going to be very excited about going down that same road. But again,
I mean,
it really strikes me.
That's one reporter's thing. I've seen others on TV saying, yummy. You know, yeah. I don't know if it's
We funky. Have seen the grocery manufacturers do the same thing for decades, Tom. It's called line extensions, where they will put out a lower fat, lower sugar, lower salt version of their products. It sits on the shelf. And they're happy to do that because it makes more money for them, because it doesn't do anything to detract from the mainline product. If anything, it encourages people to eat more. And there may, in fact, be some problem from a nutritional standpoint. Look at diet soda. I mean, there's a sense, and people are starting to realize that diet foods, you know, may give you a false sense of being, for example, prophylactic against more calories. So you have that diet soda, and then you have that extra large muffin thinking the calories aren't going to affect you. You know, I really wanted to see the food giants sort of go at this. And I went to Nestle, the largest food company of all in Switzerland. They have 700 PhDs working on things like manipulating the size of fat globules to give us a better mouthfeel sensation. compensation for less fat contact.
Okay.
But the first thing they said to me was that we are years away. There is no silver bullet in this. And in the meantime, those companies are totally hooked on using huge amounts of salt, sugar, fat to get the low cost, convenience, and maximize the allure. And I'm not seeing that changing anytime soon.
Well, I mean, we know where we've been. We're trying to think about where we might be going. ML in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. ML, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, as much as I do hate to call in because I know your guests who disagree with the callers always have the last word. I just felt I had to because my blood is boiling over.
Let's hear it. Lay it down, ML.
Okay. I think this is a typical surreal quote-unquote conversation because the issue really is a socio-political issue. You know, let's be honest, name the real problem. We need to make real and healthy food affordable to all. And that starts with decent living wages and access to good food in every corner of the nation. And for me, you know, this ties in with what Robert Wright was talking about on this mm-hmm. program the other day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, inequality for all. Yes, I can afford the good food here. I'm lucky and I know it. But my heart bleeds that it's not like that for everyone. And I think that, you know, we need to provide that for people. So my last point is that, of course, the industrial food complex has found a nice advocate with people like, you know, David Freeman. And I just wonder how much dirty money he gets from the junk food industry.
ML, we're going to bring it all up for you. We won't let it just float away at all. Okay, David, let's pick this up. You know, I'm looking at a headline here. This is just from this month. It says the food deserts we hear a lot about. They're often blamed for U.S. obesity, often inner city areas with not enough supermarkets with full produce sections. And the nationwide study found that it's income, not food deserts, that are to blame for most U.S. obesity. I mean, ML's painting this picture as sort of a dystopia where we're feeding scientifically made junk to a bunch of impoverished serfs, rather than having a great, bounteous economy for all where we eat beautiful stuff off the land. And she wonders about who's promoting this.
Well, apparently, to hear ML tell it, and I've heard this accusation much, I must be paid by the food industry to advocate them. First of all, I say black and white in my article, I eat healthy food. And second of all, I totally advocate intense regulation of the food industry. I'd love to see that. The food industry generally doesn't pay people to say that. I've never accepted a dime from the food industry. The only journalists I know who have gotten really wealthy off of talking about food are Michael Pollan and perhaps Michael Moss. I don't know. It sure isn't me. But, you know, I will say that, okay, if you truly believe the food companies cannot improve, in spite of the fact that we actually see them improving,
mm-hmm.
if you still want to insist you know these companies better than anyone else and they won't do it, what's your plan, folks? What's the alternative? How do you get people to eat vegetables? How do you make this food available and affordable and get people to switch to them? We've been trying. We've failed. I've never heard anybody come with anything close to a reasonable plan. We can't make these companies go away. Regulation keeps failing. What's the alternative? This is clearly our best bet.
Okay, Michael Moss, what's the plan? I mean, I have a job, and when I go to the farmer's market, I'm a little careful because the prices are pretty high. And I have a job, you know.
High. No, they're absolutely high, and I'm not willing to give up on those people for whom going to Burger King isn't a lark. It's going for their basic food that they are dependent on day in, day out because it's cheap and it's there for them and they are living in these food deserts. I'm not about to give up on them. There's no question that just telling people that they need to double their consumption of fruits and vegetables for optimum health is going to work. It's not working. But when you look at the resources that the USDA puts into promoting processed food, highly processed food, versus fruits and vegetables, it's staggering.
How do they put resources into that? You mean subsidizing corn and soybeans? Or
that and also investment in research and development. That's really what made corn so powerful and so ubiquitous as an ingredient is the amount of research that went into making it incredibly productive and cost-effective for farmers to grow. You don't see anything of that kind of a Manhattan Project going into making fruits and vegetables easier to grow, less expensive.
Yep.
That in marketing as well. You have to remember that's a huge part of the equation for the food companies in selling their products. The marketing Madison Avenue has to be there for fruits and vegetables in order for that to work.
I mean, they'll go where the buyers are. There's a very hard edge on our caller ML's question about sociopolitics that leave us, get rid of a middle class. You got a lot of people who need the cheapest thing you can extrude out the end of the tube. On the other hand, Michael, it seems like there's a hard edge in David's question, though, as well. Like, fine and good to say all this, but what portion of our society is eating well today, is at the farmer's market, is eating that ideal plate? And if it's not big enough, what's the real plan for changing that?
And again, I'm just not willing to give up on that larger portion of America that can't shop at the farmer's market or eat and afford fruits and vegetables even when they walk into the grocery store because they are more expensive. The plan is not there. You're absolutely right. But one thing I think we can sort of think about and start thinking about is what would the food giants do if they suddenly had to start selling fruits and vegetables instead of processed food, not because they have some new moral compass, but to make more money. And that's actually something I've started thinking about.
How would they change the production, the whole thing? Larry in Waterloo, Iowa. Larry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey, exciting discussion. There is reason to be still on the point. But, hey, come on, let's not rain on this idea of making better processed food. I was pretty excited about the guy from Bien. I mean, you're talking about a guy that's talking about producing and throwing money at making better, healthier processed food. I mean, let's not discount that idea. That's something that should be run with. Processed food is not going to go away anytime soon, so why not try to make it better?
Larry, I appreciate your call. Excited to hear about this. Yes, skeptical, but let's not rain on the parade too fast. I appreciate your call, Larry. Let's get a couple more right here. Ken in Cambridge, Vermont. Ken, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, food guests. I think this is a great idea, processed healthy food. I made a whole list of why I think it's a good idea, but most of the points were already made. So I'll try to come up with something original. I like the idea of, my wife and I have basically been counting our calories, trying to lose weight, because we get to the point where we have to lose weight, and we were spending a lot of money, as your callers were saying, on fruits and vegetables. It's like, oh boy, our shopping bill, really went up. To come up with recipes, every night that are calorie conscious and things like that. It's getting hard. I need help from high tech here. Come up with some new recipes for me.
Bring it on.
Help me out.
I mean, Michael Pollan says, so does Bittman. They say, Mark Bittman, they say, cook. Take it to the kitchen and cook. And the process of just walking, going to buy the stuff, coming home, cooking, it'll slow you down. You'll be healthier in the end. But there is that issue, David, that people, they end up kind of up against it. I don't have time. I haven't shopped today. I don't know what to make with all this spinach laying on the counter. we are fallible creatures.
Hey, tell me about it. Look, I would love to see everybody in America get around the kitchen table at night with their families around a wonderful home-cooked farm-to-table meal. That would be just fantastic. What a lovely scene. I wish it can happen. It can't. It won't in the foreseeable future. We have no way of knowing how to make that happen. People really increasingly want to lose the weight. It's an absolute health catastrophe. It's adding up to a billion years of lost human life in America alone in the coming decades. We have to do something about this. We know what foods they are eating and that they can afford to eat. It is simply a no-brainer to try to support every way we can the effort to get the calories and fat and sugar in those foods down.
We've got a lot of people pressing to get in here. I can't get to all of them, but Julia in Green Bay, Wisconsin is saying, come on, just make some effort. It's not so expensive if you put effort into finding those fresh vegetables. Gina says, hey, she's all for meatless burgers in Arkansas. Corrine is in Connecticut saying, this processed food being cheaper is all a construct made out of farm subsidies. Let's turn that around. Caitlin, do you feel You know, Silicon Valley has spotted big new horizons before and driven us there. Do you feel the kind of energy in this movement that could get us past over the hump and out of this sort of unhealthy processed realm that we have been in for a long time?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think Beyond Meat is one of the most exciting companies right now in this field. And I think that the fact that there are investors like BizStone behind a project like Beyond Meat is a good sign. Again, it's not the solve to everyone's problems, but the fact that that innovative thinkers who want to make money are thinking about ways to address this problem can only be good for us. It's good to see them test possibilities. And then you have, you know, extreme sort of comical examples, like you have Rob Reinhart, the guy who started that maltodextrin slurry you mentioned earlier, Tom, which is essentially, it's called Soylent, and it's essentially a food replacement so that he wouldn't have to think about and spend time cooking, right? Like I have no interest in drinking Soylent to replace meals, but the fact that that there are people actually trying to address the problem of the time it takes to cook and the cost of cooking and fruits and vegetables not always being within reach is going to be good for us all.
It's kind of a head spinner. Michael Moss, you're a great skeptic. What's your test for whether it's real? How are you going to test? We got just a few seconds here, Michael.
Well, first thing, I'm going to taste those French fries, which I haven't yet. I mean, that's okay. If those things deliver the mouthfeel that goes to the pleasure center of my brain, like real French fries loaded, hey, more power to them.
Okay, the taste test will be first, and a lot more tests behind. Economic, scientific, socio-political, it's all on the table with food and in a very interesting chapter. Michael Moss is author of Salt, Sugar, Fat. Michael, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
David Friedman, author of Wrong and the big Atlantic piece, linked to it at our website. David, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
And Caitlin with her big Wired magazine cover. Check it out. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.